This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, the dark side of America's rehab industry. The United States is in the grip of a devastating opioid epidemic. Since 1999, more than a million Americans have died of drug overdoses. And while fatal overdoses have fallen in recent years, hundreds of thousands of people continue to cycle through treatment programs, many of which fail to help them achieve lasting recovery.
There's no snap of the finger magic cure for addiction. It can be a long-term problem and a complicated problem to solve.
That's Shoshana Walter. She's covered the addiction treatment system in the U.S. for years. As a reporter at Reveal, she co-hosted the podcast series American Rehab. And in her new book, Rehab, An American Scandal, she lays out how the very system meant to help people recover has too often failed them, and in some cases, even exploited them. She argues that this system bears responsibility for prolonging America's addiction crisis.
Someone who's entering a treatment program is especially vulnerable because they have accepted that they have a problem and they want help. And now their lives are being put in the hands of treatment providers that often have good intentions, but many programs often don't.
I started by asking Shoshana to explain the origins of our addiction treatment system and how it's evolved over time.
Over the past 25 plus years of the opioid epidemic, our country has really undergone an enormous transformation in terms of how we approach and treat drug addiction. You know, during the crack cocaine epidemic, we really treated addiction as more of a moral failing that was deserving of punishment. It was criminalized, and we incarcerated people, disproportionately Black and brown drug users, en masse. And then with the opioid epidemic, the pain pill epidemic, it started out mainly affecting white communities, and our country undertook a very different approach to addiction. You know, suddenly lawmakers were describing it as a disease, one that deserved some compassion. The people who got hooked were victims of addiction, and they deserved treatment. And so we undertook this enormous expansion of our addiction treatment system. We launched this gold standard treatment medication, Suboxone, in 2002. And then we expanded addiction treatment coverage under the Affordable Care Act to millions of Americans. And so I think there was this idea that treatment could be the solution to this massive public health problem. And treatment certainly has helped many, many people. I don't want to understate that. But the treatment system that we've developed as a result of the opioid epidemic is just not working the way that lawmakers intended. And oftentimes it's fueling relapse and overdose death rates than actually helping people achieve long-term recovery.
Well, I definitely want to talk more about rehabs and what you see as some of the big problems with rehabs and the way that they're structured today, the programs are structured. But you just mentioned Suboxone, which is seen as the sort of gold standard of medicated treatment for opioid addiction today. Can you just back up a bit and explain what is Suboxone, what's known about it, what do we know about how effective it is?
I like to think of it as almost kind of similar to nicotine gum in a way, in that it's like a substitute for illicit opioids. You take it, it's available in a pill form or in a film form, and now also available as a shot. An opioid user who takes it, it quells their cravings, it prevents the onset of withdrawal symptoms, and it stimulates the same receptors in the brain as opioids do, and kind of takes the place of misused drugs. It has to be prescribed by a medical provider, and oftentimes that's done in a clinic setting. Also, rehab patients can get it in residential treatment programs. It sort of depends, because a lot of residential treatment programs are abstinence-based as well, so they don't want people taking any medications at all. But then there's a growing number of treatment programs where you can go and you can get Suboxone, and it makes someone who's used to taking illicit drugs feel normal again. That's what I've heard again and again from people who've taken it.
And what's known about its efficacy?
Medications like Suboxone, buprenorphine, methadone are known to reduce overdose deaths by more than 50%. So they're one of the key tools in this fight against the opioid crisis. Someone who takes it for a period of 6 months or longer is far less likely to overdose and die than someone who doesn't get that medication at all.
And if that's the case, I mean, you write about this in the book, but why has there been so much resistance from courts, from rehab centers, even from some families to using Suboxone?
There's a long-held stigma in this country against utilizing drugs or medications to treat addiction. There's an ongoing perception that despite this transformation we've had of more people considering addiction to be a disease, there's still this long-held perception that if someone wants sobriety enough, if they want to get better, then they can. And they should be able to do it without any help. Kind of like a pull yourself up by the bootstraps mentality. That is a mentality and culture that pervades our treatment and recovery communities to this day.
You know, we've seen recent headlines about fatal overdoses declining. Mm-hmm. What's the story behind that number to you? I mean, what are they a reflection of? Are they a reflection of treatment improving or something else?
The first thing to know is that the decline in overdose deaths, it's fallen to near pre-pandemic levels. And so one possibility is just that we're seeing a drop back down to the still astronomical number of deaths that we were seeing before that huge uptick during the pandemic when so many people died for various reasons. Some people posit that harm reduction efforts have helped reduce overdose deaths, that a lot of people who might overdose and die are actually having their overdoses reversed and they're surviving. Another theory is that some of the most vulnerable people have already passed away. And so perhaps there are fewer deaths because the people who are still using are not as vulnerable and marginalized as some of the people who died during this pandemic era.
Oh, that's quite grim, but I understand the logic behind it.
Exactly. It is. It's so disturbing. And I also think that, you know, we've seen recently a lot of cuts to treatment funding and to funding of harm reduction services. And studies are showing that that will lead to an uptick in overdose deaths. So I think it still remains to be seen how that will affect our overdose death rates. But all signs point to likely seeing those numbers start to track up again.
Well, what you do so well in this book is you follow the stories of several people whose lives have been impacted by this in different ways. I was hoping we could get into one of those stories in particular. You talk about a man named Chris Kuhn, who you also interviewed for the podcast American Rehab that you reported with Reveal. Can you tell us a bit of Chris's story and his experience of trying to find help, trying to find treatment for his addiction in the early 2000s?
Absolutely, yeah. Chris is a young, middle-class white guy from rural Louisiana. He started off experimenting with drugs when he was a teenager, and he broke his ankle showing off on a three-wheeler, and he got a pain pill prescription, and that ended up turning into an addiction.
One time, I was at my granny's house, and I saw this paperwork out one day. She was looking into buying me a funeral plot, like a plot of land by my grandpa. That's an eye-opener, too. Whenever you see that your people are buying you a fucking cemetery plot, and I'm like, I'm 23 years old, and they're planning on burying me.
His parents were desperate to help him. They sent him to a 30-day program. It was a good program. He went, he came back, he immediately relapsed. Such a common story for people who go through these 30-day programs. And then soon after that, he was arrested and court-ordered into this program called the Senecor Foundation. And what Chris and his mom and his granny took him to the program were told was that he would get medical care and treatment and counseling in the program. He would be there for 2 years. He would live and work there and be able to save money for when he left rehab. But once he started, he realized it was something else entirely.
Right. So CentiCor, the program that Chris is sent to, this is a nonprofit. It is one of the biggest private providers of drug addiction and alcohol abuse treatment in Texas, but it has a rocky history. Can you tell us a little bit more about CentiCor and Chris's experience there?
Well, this program was based on a program that was founded in 1958 called Synanon that turned into something of a cult. And one of the practices that Synanon pioneered was this group circle activity called The Game, where someone sits in the middle of the circle and everyone screams at them about their flaws and character deficits and confronts them about all of the issues with their personality. So this was one of the practices that Chris immediately began to participate in when he arrived at CentiCor. There was a lot of punishment-driven practices in the program that really brought Chris down to his absolute lowest, most depressed point. And then after the first 30 days in the program, Chris also learned that he would be required to work. And he was sent up to 80 hours per week at really tough manual labor jobs, working at chemical plants, cleaning up after LSU football games, laying asphalt in the boiling Louisiana heat.
One day you might go work at a restaurant. The next day you might go work at a place that bags up mulch, where you're throwing 50-pound bags of mulch for 12 hours. That was usually a punishment job. If you got in trouble, that's where they sent you.
And he wasn't paid anything for this work. Mm. His only compensation was a single pack of cigarettes per week. And this was basically his sole form of treatment.
They talk about you like you were just, like you were inventory, like you weren't even a person. I've heard bosses talking, being like, yeah, we need to order like 5 more CentiCors for tomorrow. Or come up to you and be like, hey, CentiCor, come here.
And who was that benefiting, that labor, just to be clear? I mean, did CentiCor have relationships with groups, with corporations?
Yeah, so CentiCor basically utilized their patients as a temporary labor force, and they would send them out every day onto these jobs working at for-profit companies. Among them were Exxon and Shell oil refineries for a time. And the companies or the subcontractors that sent them to the companies would pay CentiCor for the labor, but none of the pay went on to the patients themselves. It all went back to the program. Mm-hmm. And what I found when I was reporting on the program is that CentiCor was making far more from this unpaid labor than they needed in order to actually keep the program financially running. Oh, so they were profiting off of these unpaid workers.
How typical is this of other rehab facilities? I've certainly heard about the practice of unpaid labor being used in prisons. How widespread is this at rehab facilities?
Yeah, it's actually shockingly more common than you would think. I was a reporter at Reveal about 8 years ago when I just stumbled across a program that courts were sending people to in Louisiana and Arkansas. I learned that this one particular program had been founded by a former poultry industry executive and was actually sending people to work without pay at chicken processing plants. Mm. And that started me out on this whole reporting thread, working with several colleagues. And we ended up finding hundreds of similar programs operating across the United States. And these are programs that are really catering to people who don't have insurance coverage, who need longer-term treatment because insurance often doesn't pay for longer-term treatment. Mm-hmm. So these programs are stepping in to fill this void and this need. And the way that they are at least partially funding themselves is through the uncompensated labor of their patients. And what I saw time and again with CentiCor and many other programs is that that arrangement can become easily exploited. And regulators rarely step in to protect them from this kind of abuse.
Well, that was going to be my next question because it sounds so blatantly exploitative, as you're saying. What regulation is supposed to exist? Who's the oversight here? Who's responsible for this?
Each state regulates rehabs completely differently. So, you know, these unpaid labor programs that I was just describing, oftentimes they're faith-based programs that don't allow medical care or medications on the premises. And these programs are also often exempt from licensure. So you have rehabs operating across the country that don't have any oversight at all. And then you also have these insurance-funded programs that are supposed to be licensed and certified and regulated in each state. But what I found time and again, especially in California, where one of the storylines takes place in my book, is that even when programs were doing extremely dangerous things, for example, giving patients medications that were not prescribed to them and contributing to overdoses within their programs, regulators were not shutting the program down. Mm. Oftentimes, regulators will come in, they'll do a cursory investigation, and if they find a violation, they'll offer the rehab a chance to submit a corrective action plan. The rehab will say what they're going to do to solve the problem, and that's it. The rehab is allowed to continue operating even when the same problems occur again and again and again, and even when patients' lives are endangered.
And what about some of the other details in Chris's story of the programs there that involved what felt like sort of stripping people down to their lowest point? I mean, what do people understand about how that kind of approach has an effect on people who are trying to get better?
When I was reporting on Senecora, I interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people who had gone through the program. And, you know, some people said that that strategy or that approach did help them. But then there were others that it traumatized them. Chris was one of them. And what studies have found is that, especially for people who have histories of trauma and mental health struggles, that style of treatment can be more harmful than helpful.
And just to point out, I mean, Senecor still exists today. It's still operational. How has it responded to your reporting, particularly about its work program?
Yeah, well, I initially reported on Senecor a few years ago when I was still a reporter at Reveal. And after our reporting came out, Senecor actually shut down that particular program. So it no longer exists. And several rehab participants from the Senecor program sued Senecor, and that lawsuit was settled just this past year. Senecor has sort of shifted gears to focus more on insurance-funded treatment and even providing Suboxone. But similar programs continue to operate across the country. It's still very much a continuing problem.
Mm. So what happened to Chris after Senecor? How did he leave Senecor, and how did his story end as we leave him in the book?
So Chris, he was at Senecor for 18 months. He was really floundering in the program. He relapsed several times with drugs that he found on the job. And also, he got injured on the job. He never got adequate medical care for his injury. And then eventually, just a few months after that, he contracted MRSA. Senecor basically told him that he had to leave because they didn't want other patients catching it. They told him he could come back, but when he left and went back to court, he learned that Senecor had kicked him out of the program right before the phase of the program when he would have been able to start saving a percentage of the money that he earned through his work. Mm. And, you know, he fully expected, because he'd been kicked out of this program after 18 months, that he would be sentenced to prison by the judge. But the judge gave him a second chance and gave Chris probation. And Chris basically began to start his life all over again. After he left Senecor, you know, he found himself struggling again. And so he went to his parents and he asked them for help. And they helped him pay for a Suboxone prescription. And that's what helped Chris. He got a welding certificate and he found a job and he got married. And Chris is still sober today.
Mm. Well, I should just point out, too, that before he went to Senecor, it sounds like Chris tried several times to get a hold of Suboxone, which was relatively new at the time, and that it seemed like it was really hard for him to do that. Can you talk about some of the reasons why? And it sounds like his experience is maybe kind of a typical one.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when Chris was looking to get on Suboxone, he had such a hard time finding a doctor willing to prescribe it. And then the doctor that he did find to prescribe it only accepted cash. He didn't accept insurance. And that is a very common experience of people trying to find addiction treatment medications in the United States. When Suboxone was first launched, the Drug Enforcement Administration was pretty against it. And lawmakers imposed these very strict patient limits and oversight by the Drug Enforcement Administration. And doctors also had to receive specialized training to prescribe Suboxone and submit themselves to inspections by the Drug Enforcement Administration. And so it became enormously difficult for patients to access it. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, you know, over the course of this epidemic, more than 1 million people have died of overdoses, and people still have trouble accessing these medications. When France was having their own heroin epidemic in the mid-90s, they actually made buprenorphine, which is the drug underlying Suboxone, as widely available to as many people as who needed it. Mm. And as a result of that effort, overdose deaths declined by 79% over a period of 4 years. And so I've talked with experts who say, you know, if we had taken a different approach, made this medication as widely available as it needed to be, maybe we wouldn't have lost quite so many lives.
Mm. Mm. It almost sounds like an overregulation problem rather than an underregulation problem, right?
Yeah.
And maybe a bit of an overcorrection too, a reaction to the opioid crisis in the first place and what created it.
I think so. And I mean, honestly, when Suboxone was first launched, it was in 2002, and so there wasn't as much of an awareness of pill mills just yet. And so it's kind of ironic, in fact, you know, the DEA was so concerned about Suboxone becoming the drug problem. In fact, OxyContin and pain pills became the drug problem. That's what ended up overtaking the country. You know, the DEA thought that by suppressing Suboxone, they would be suppressing a drug problem, when in fact, they kind of fed the problem by limiting the treatment available for it.
I was hoping we would have time for you to tell us about one more person's story in the book. You write about April Lee. Mm. Can you tell us about April's story?
Yeah, absolutely. So April is Black. She's a mom of three. She's in Philadelphia. And her mom, Nadine, was addicted to crack cocaine. And so April grew up kind of seeing our country's approach to addiction during the 80s and 90s, which was to incarcerate, particularly in Black and brown communities. And for mothers in particular during this time, there was no treatment to speak of. And April, she had always envisioned kind of she would have a totally different life for herself. She wouldn't follow in the same path as her mother, but she did end up developing an addiction, first to pain pills and then to heroin. And what I found in my book is that actually not much has changed since the crack cocaine epidemic, particularly for mothers like April. Over the course of the opioid epidemic, the number of treatment programs that cater to women with children have declined drastically. Mm. We were talking earlier about overdose deaths starting to decline. Among mothers, for the past few years, overdose deaths have started to skyrocket. And today, a woman who has children has basically no treatment options. Only about 2.5% of facilities allow women to bring their children with them, and only about 4.5% offer childcare. And that's significant because we've known for decades that treatment programs that allow women to remain with their children have better outcomes for families. Mm. And so really the options for mothers who are addicted are arrest, separation from their kids, and grimly, often overdose death. And April, her experience of the system was exactly that. She was separated from her three kids. She desperately wanted treatment and couldn't find it. And then when she had truly had enough and just wanted something, anything to stop this cycle of addiction, she basically had herself arrested. That was the beginning of her process to getting sober.
Wow. It sounds like she also, at some point, entered a 30-day rehab program. Mm-hmm. You say in the book that 30-day programs really aren't effective for opioid addiction, or aren't as effective as they might be for something like alcohol abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? And why are relapses so common after these 30-day programs?
So we now know from studies that someone who completes a 30-day treatment program is far more likely to overdose and die in the year following treatment than someone who failed to complete it at all.
I mean, that's so counterintuitive.
It's so counterintuitive.
It's exactly what you would not expect. What is happening there?
Yeah. So basically, someone who enters a 30-day program or someone who enters prison or jail, they're entering a period of abstinence. You know, they're no longer using the substance that they were addicted to. They are in this program for a period of time. Their tolerance level goes down. They leave that program. And because that program is just not enough time and hasn't provided them with any ongoing support, they leave and they relapse. It's such a common problem. Mm-hmm. And then because their tolerance level for their drug of choice has been reduced, they take the same amount of that substance. In this case, oftentimes it might be fentanyl. And that same amount that they previously took is now too much for them. And so they overdose. And oftentimes that ends up being fatal.
Mm. Well, April was able to get sober ultimately. What made the difference for her?
April got herself arrested. She begged the jail to help her find some place to go, you know, a residential rehab program, a recovery program, something. She just happened to luck out and heard about this recovery house where she went immediately after leaving jail. And it was a huge struggle. I mean, she went to 12-step meetings, and slowly through those 12-step meetings, she met people who introduced her to other people. And she very, very, very slowly got on her feet. I mean, it took her years to get her children back, but she did.
Mm.
And now, today, she is the founder of a nonprofit that is helping mothers who are addicted. And I would say, too, the other thing that I really learned in reporting on this book is that I found that what happens after treatment is often more important than what happened during the treatment itself. So by that, I mean, there are certain pieces that are incredibly important for people to enter recovery and sustain and maintain that recovery. This is what researchers refer to as recovery capital. And that could include community, social support. It also includes things like housing, economic security, jobs, transportation, food, healthcare. Mm. You know, someone who goes into treatment like April without these resources, it's going to be much more difficult for them than someone like Chris, who has a family who can offer some financial support, who can get help paying for something like Suboxone, who can rely on family to help him pay for education that can help him find a better job. So unless people are able to access that recovery capital after they leave treatment, they're going to have a much harder time climbing out of their addiction.
Mm. Well, so after speaking to so many people who have struggled with addiction themselves, people who watched a loved one struggle with it,
mm-hmm.
what are you walking away with as the most urgent changes needed to the way that addiction is treated in the U.S. today?
I mean, for one, even though treatment access has expanded, there are so many people in the country who don't have access to treatment, or there's barriers to treatment. And so increasing treatment access is a huge piece of this puzzle. And also reducing barriers to addiction treatment medications. You know, now we've gotten rid of this special waiver program that was required to prescribe Suboxone, but still, so many doctors are not willing to prescribe it. And so it still remains difficult for people to access those medications. Mm. And then I think the bigger question is the harder question to answer. And that is, in order to recover from addiction, people need housing and healthcare and food and transportation and community. And those are the resources that treatment programs are often not able to provide. That is a huge piece of the puzzle, providing people with these resources that they need to actually be able to facilitate change in their lives.
Mm. Shoshana, thank you for your years of reporting on this topic and for talking with us about it.
Thanks so much for having me.
You can find Shoshana Walter's book, Rehab, An American Scandal, on Apple Books. We'll include a link to it on our show notes page.